Keris Matthews, and this is the Tell Me the Truth About Life podcast. Poems that matter, and why. It's launched for National Poetry Day's 25th anniversary. I love to champion poetry because when someone shares a poem with you, it gives you an insight both into the person who shared it with you and the world we live in. A wonderful poet, Wendy Cope, once said, "When a poem doesn't work, the first question to ask yourself is, am I telling the truth?" I don't know about you, but for me, she's definitely onto something there. And in a loud and frantic world, a poem makes space to be heard properly. It allows room for a conversation, for ideas, debate, and search for truth. And now more than ever, poetry feels vital. So for National Poetry Day's anniversary, I've been asking people from all walks of life, astronauts, criminologists, footballers, comedians, to tell me what lines of poetry speak truth to them and why. And with their help, I've curated a people's anthology. It's been like dropping a net into an ocean, because when someone reads you a poem and tells you why it matters to them, a whole world opens up. Because conversations about words that really matter allow people to touch upon their feelings. Because things that are hidden or silenced can come to light. In this podcast series, author Michael Mopurgo, Instagram poet Nikita Gill, actor Jay DeNuca, teacher Kate Clancy, and comedian Henry Normal each take us on a tour of their touchstone poems. In conversation here with Susanna Herbert of the Forward Arts Foundation. You'll find lines of Emily Dickinson next to those of Simon Armitage, Maya Angelou near Adrian Henry, Shelley, alongside other treasured words. All these contributors feature in the anthology I've curated. It's called Tell Me the Truth About Life, a National Poetry Day anthology, 100 Poems That Matter. It's published by Michael O'Mara Books to celebrate the 25th anniversary of National Poetry Day. There's Liz Berry, Alice Oswald, John Cooper Clarke, Raymond Antrobus, Caroline Duffy, and the youngest featured, Mukahanglimbu, was just 14 when he wrote his poem, A New Arrival in England from Nepal. I hope you enjoy it.
And I'm Susanna Herbert. I run National Poetry Day. My guest is Michael Mopurgo, who is an extraordinary writer and creator of stories, who over his career has written, I think, more than 200 stories, although he rather deliberately avoids the title of author and thinks of himself more as a maker of stories. Michael, well known to many through War Horse, which of course was performed as a play as well as being a book and a film, knows all the different ways in which language and words can connect people and build connections. Michael.
Hello there. My mother's the person who started all this. She was an actress. She would have called herself an actor now. Good actor too. And she used to love reading to us, Peter and myself, when we were little things, what she loved. She had a beautiful voice and would read us Masefield, Kipling, all these sort of people that, I suppose, Charles Gardner verses. So Stevenson was there as well. She would read the ones we loved again and again and again, which we liked, because repetition is very important when you're about four or five. And here's the thing, what I learned from her, is that words are not words, they're musical notes. When they're said right, when they're not affected, when they're not trying to make you think this or believe that, they're played. They're really played. And she could do that with her voice. And so I learned a love of words, I think, and we can call that a love of poetry, before I really learned anything else about stories. And then sadly, I went to school and all that was knocked out of me because stories and words became these dreadful lessons which you had to answer questions about and you had to punctuate and handwriting had to be perfect. And there were rules. And I rather rebelled about that and I hardly read a book until I was 15 after that.
Now, I'm very interested in what you say about words before poetry and the musical element of words. The poem that you nominated for National Poetry Day, or the anthology Tell Me the Truth About Life, is a poem that I would love you to read aloud and to tell us a little bit about, because it is a poem which is primarily made to be remembered. And the meaning, if you like, is secondary, and yet the meaning is more than it looks.
It is. And I should mention who wrote it. It was Leo Marx, I think, wrote it in 1943, something like that. It's called The Life That I Have. The Life That I Have. The life that I have is all that I have. And the life that I have is yours. The love that I have, of the life that I have, is yours and yours and yours. A sleep I shall have, a rest I shall have. Yet death will be but a pause for the peace of my years in the long green grass. Will be yours, and yours, and yours. So, I think I first heard that poem in a film with the voice of Virginia McKenna, who coincidentally I've come to know very well over the years. We do story making and concerts together. It was a film called Carve Her Name with Pride, which is the story of the French secret agent Violette Sabo. She plays Violette, and it's the story of an ordinary enough girl who happened to speak French, married a Frenchman who was killed, and then she joined the Special Operations Executive, and this is the story of what happened to her, played by Virginia McKenna. And the reason that the poem is in there is because of the man who wrote it, Leo Marx, who wrote, I suppose you'd almost say, if you had to, jingles that secret agents could easily remember for coding purposes and decoding purposes. So that nothing had to be written down, which was very important. Well, he wrote this, so goodness knows how he sat down and just wrote that. But what it is, it's wonderfully simple in many ways. The rhythm is extraordinary. The music in it is extraordinary. It's touching. I've heard it read since, and I don't know how many funerals, and it means a lot to a lot of people. And I think it is not just because of the film. Very few people watch that film now. But the poem now almost outlives the film, which is rather extraordinary. So I think he would be rather pleased that this poem has insinuated itself really into the national consciousness in the way that it has. And it's a poem for everyone. This is not a poem that you would necessarily find on the pages of the Times Literary Supplement. It's a poem which everyone can enjoy. It's a universal enjoyment, understanding, binds people together. And I love poetry that does that. And it's the song in it. I wonder why it hasn't been put to music. We should talk to Keris Matthews and get her to do that. you'd think it needs music. It actually doesn't, because the words do it anyway. But it has a lovely rhythm. I didn't read it very well then if I'd had...
You read it beautifully because you gave the word space to breathe. And so if you like, you get the silences between the words, which are important in music, as in your reading. Is there any particular line there which would stand out as one which ticks through one's head?
Well, it's the second verse, really. The love that I have of the life that I have is yours and yours and yours. And what that means, you know, that this life I have, I'm living and I have had, is worthwhile because of you. And it's the most extraordinary declaration of commitment. It's very, very beautiful. If I would be around at my funeral, I would really like this read. As it is, I don't much mind what is read, but it certainly, although it's very moving, and your voice catches sometimes when you're reading it, and certainly when you hear it, it is something about human love and our need for each other, which we all understand, and that's been caught.
Now, one of the things that really impresses me about people who love poetry is that they can often remember things by heart. And I used to think it was because they were exceptional people. But increasingly, I'm beginning to understand that it's also because there's something in the nature of poetry which is designed to be remembered. It's almost as if going back to the history of poetry to the very first poets before paper, the only way you could ensure that something important lasted was to make it memorable. Therefore, you would use poetry. It was the tricks of it, the repetitions and the rhythm were a means to an end.
Yes, absolutely.
And the end was to transmit or to send on something important. So down the generations or from one country to another. So I know that prayers are written in poetry. Songs can often be reimagined as poetry. We don't know if Homer sang. We don't know. We don't know quite a lot about how poetry was shared earlier on, because all we have is the written version, and that's a kind of reduction. But would you tell me what poetry can do in your eyes that other forms of writing perhaps can't?
Yes, I can make an attempt at it. I mean, I'm a story maker. That's what I do. I'm not a poet. I do think poetry is the supreme form of literature, simply because it uses so few words to say much more. There's something about the intensity of that, and it's probably why I can't do it. It always seemed to me out of my reach. Now, I loved reciting poetry when I was younger, and we had to learn it at school, which did put me off a great deal because I wasn't particularly good at learning. I wasn't particularly good at doing anything when I was told to do it. And particularly if there was a threat. And the threat was really that you'd have to stay in detention and learn it again because you didn't learn it well enough last night, which is kind of not the way to do it. But having said that, if you can have poems inside your head or songs inside your head, I think that really enriches you in a way which is beyond imagining, because you can't do that with stories. I mean, I can tell the tale of a story that I've written, and it actually sounds rather mundane. I hope the paragraphs don't, but the story of the story does. But if you read a poem, and you try, when you read it, to forget yourself and lose yourself totally in a poem in the same way as when you're listening to a Bach cantata or a Mozart symphony, you just lose yourself in it while speaking it. You remove the ego. One of the things I've learned about singing, I occasionally sing with a folk group from time to time, and the business of singing with people is the same. There is simply the sound. There isn't you and a bunch of other people. It's the sound. And it's the same thing when you're reading a poem, particularly a poem you love. I think that's the criteria that's important, certainly for me when I was a teacher. I was a teacher about 8 years at the Coalface. And it was very important when I was reading poetry that I wasn't trying to say, no, this is really impressive. No, you just climb inside the words, climb inside the rhythm of the line, forget the children in front of you, and see it in your mind's eye as you're doing it, and hear it in your mind's ear. And that's what I tried to do as a teacher, and I suppose that's what I've continued to do. But I do know I can't write poetry. I'm finding this interview very humiliating, because I would really love in my next life, and I'm not sort of joking about this really, I would love to have risen to that level, to have that kind of intensity of Heaney or Hughes, who really can, within two or three lines, do what I do in 100 pages, but rather better.
Well, you've mentioned two poets who are very important to the history of poetry and to the presence of poetry, because they matter even though they're not with us. Their words survive. Would you like to choose a poem from one there?
Yes, I would. I was lucky. We were very lucky, my wife and I. We moved down to Devon to work on a project, begin a project called Farms for City Children years and years ago, 43 years ago. And in those years, about 100,000 kids have come down, lived and worked on the farm. And it was very hard to start with because there was no one around who was particularly interested, except some teachers who used to bring their children. But we couldn't, to raise money and profile was very hard. And we were lucky because 4 miles down the road lived a man called Ted Hughes. And he became an friend and the first president and supporter of the charity. And he wrote, of course, massively about the countryside that I used to take the children around on. And I literally could walk along the river that Hughes walked and read poems to the children about whether it was a kingfisher or a heron or where the otters went, and so we could find a spraint and pick it up, and then you'd read a poem. So there was a connection between these words and this countryside they were walking in, breathing in. Ted Hughes wrote this poem, I think, with some anger in his heart about the way we treat nature around us. And he was formidable in defense of it and protection of it. And this is called My Own True Family. Once I crept in an oak wood. I was looking for a stag. I met an old woman there, all knobbly stick and rag. She said, I have your secret here inside my little bag. Then she began to cackle and I began to quake. She opened up her little bag and I came twice awake, surrounded by a staring tribe and me tied to a stake. They said, we are the oak trees and your own true family. We are chopped down, we are torn up, you do not blink an eye. Unless you make a promise now, now you are going to die. Whenever you see an oak tree felled, swear now you will plant two. Unless you swear, the black oak bark will wrinkle over you and root you among the oaks where you were born, but never grew. This was my dream beneath the boughs. The dream that altered me. When I came out of the oak wood, back to human company, my walk was the walk of a human child, but my heart was a tree.
That is an astonishing piece of work.
It's amazing. Yeah. It should make us sit up and take notice, for goodness sakes.
My heart was a tree.
That's what I mean by intensity. You know, you didn't write a great story about it. Lots of people have done that. I've done that. Just my heart was a tree. It's a most wonderful line. And an important line, really important line. And I think he probably realised quite how important it was going to be. He was always a great fighter for the environment and for ecology and for cleaning up our rivers and all the rest of it. But I don't think he realised the speed at which this self-destruction was going on. He knew it was happening. So that's why I say there's anger, but there's also a fierce love to protect what was there.
Now, the theme of National Poetry Day this year is truth. And we, with the publisher Michael O'Mara, invited the public, as many people as possible, to nominate poems that spoke truth to them, that connected with them in some way. And we chose this instead of saying my favourite poem, because my favourite is a little bit lazy. You wanted to have a connection.
It's also like a flavour of ice cream, if you're not very careful.
Yes.
And this is different, yes. Yeah.
And what I think comes across very strongly in that reading of the poem is the connection that was forged between you and the poet, and the connection which is now forged between you and the listener.
Yeah.
Do you think that poetry or a poem can show us different ways of perceiving truth, because so much of it is literally not true?
Well, that is the same as fiction. I've heard one or two interesting arguments with academic historians about the value of fiction based on history. You know, where is the truth? Some would like to believe it's in the science of truth, which they would call history in that case. I think you can believe that. But if you wish to reach out and tell that story of history to people and bring it alive, there are other ways of doing it. And I've done that as much as I can with stories which have their roots in what has happened, but then stray from that kind of truth. And they tell another truth, which seems to me just as valid. It's simply different. With poetry, I think the truth, again, is even stronger. It's more arresting. And when you hear that poem, the truth-telling that's going on, and he wrote a wonderful book once, Ted Hughes, called What is the Truth? Which was a little bit about God and what he'd created. And, of course, you don't find out the truth necessarily. That was the point of the book. But in telling it the way he told it, he made us think about it. And that's what poetry does better than anything else. You sit back after that poem I've just read, and you just go on thinking and thinking about it, and you find your own truth. That's the telling of truth, really. It's looking someone in the eye whilst you're writing and saying, this is how I see it. You don't have to believe it, but this is how I see it. It's, in a way, the best form of human contact. Anything fake is torn away if it's a great poem. And anything fake in a poem, you see it immediately.
It is indirect, I think, and that seems to help. Emily Dickinson writes about this, tell all the truth, but tell it slant.
Yes. Yeah.
I think what seems to me evident in whenever humans use language, they do tend to approximate, because you say tree, but you may mean a particular tree.
Yes.
Everything is an approximation, a generalization.
Yes, which is leaving room.
Which leaves room for
the reader, for the listener. And that's wonderful, because it's, in a way, the poet's saying exactly that. I'm putting this out there. These are my leaves. They've fallen off the tree. You can pick them up and look at them, but I'm not telling you which leaf to pick up. You know?
Yeah. I think the idea of creating a space for a conversation, creating a space for some form of contact and communication,
yep,
is increasingly important now, when there are an awful lot of people spraying words in all direction without any real care for how they are used. And one thing, I suppose, when I'm trying to define the difference between poetry and prose, is that in most poems, it's impossible to change anything without changing all of it. It becomes a different work when a word is changed. Now, you can't say that that's quite the same when you're looking at the instructions on a cornflake packet.
No. Nor, I have to say, even... I mean, I come back... I'm not a great writer, but I write stories, and I do know that if you go back to a book that you thought was fine, a text you thought was fine, and you'd written it 10 years ago, and you go back to it, and you realise that you didn't think that through. The rhythm of that sentence doesn't somehow have its moment with the next sentence or the sentence before, and you could have done it better. And then you think, well, hang on, it's the story, stupid. Leave it. Don't get so worried about it. And actually, I don't worry about it. It is the story. But it's really important to tell the story as well as you possibly can. But you're quite right. I think every single word and comma matters in a poem. And I've known enough people around poets to know that poets get extremely, how should I say, irritated is a mild word, when someone has left out a comma and someone has left out a full stop. I mean, I grew up at school being made to put full stops and commas, which I used to sprinkle them around because the teacher just liked them anyway. And I'd never really grown out of that. But for the length of a line or the look on the page and punctuation, all that matters in a poem. It is a picture, it's a piece of music, and it's a poem altogether.
It's a score, a picture, yeah, yes, all of those things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, you spend a lot of time, I think, still going, you see a lot of children, you go to festivals, you attract immensely, you know, huge audiences, and you seem never to tire of it, which is pretty fantastic. But is there something that surprises you in the fact that poetry does seem to be becoming more popular and that young people are turning to it? I've been trying to find an answer. I don't have one, do you?
I don't know if I've got an answer, but maybe a suggestion rather than an answer. I think what children seem to really open up to is someone else who tells it as they see it or sings it as they sing it. What they don't particularly like is a sense that someone is trying to put something over on them to educate them or whatever. And if I've learned anything with children is that you must look them in the eye. I mean, yesterday I was with doing a prize giving at a school. Wonderful children. They gave you a lot of hope for the future. I mean, really extraordinary bunch of children. All girls and very, very intense when you started talking. And I knew that what you mustn't do with an audience like that is to in any way talk down to them. They are fed up with being talked down to. They do know what it is that we, that is my generation, what we have done wrong. We are in no position to preach to these people. But what you can tell them from the heart is what you feel about things. And I sang them a song last night at the end of this. This is another thing. They love it when you take a risk, when you're not being smooth about it. You know, just do it. And because I love singing, I don't love the sound of my own singing voice. It could be better. But I do love singing. So I sang him this song, which is a shepherd's song from the Béarn. Should have about 50 voices, male voices, all of them. It's just me. And you could see this is the kind of song they hadn't heard before. So that immediately made them sit up and take notice. And I could see one or two of them smiling to start with. And you sing through that. And moments later, they weren't smiling at all anymore. Because you were taking the risk, and that's an honest thing to do. And I think it's the honesty of poetry which shines through and shines through. So when someone like Siamus Heaney is talking about his childhood, for instance, This is not someone reflecting nostalgically on something because he wishes to impress you with the connection with his father and his grandfather. This is what he feels deep down, what he feels. And he has a marvellous way of having so many instruments in his orchestra and understanding exactly how to use each one. And so when you speak the poem and you are in front of an audience, the silence will. And I heard him doing this time and time again, and Hughes as well. These great poets do read very often, very, very beautifully, and they can silence an audience, not because they just adore them or because it's reputational celebrity, but because they are telling a truth. Both those great poets do that, and many others have too.
I would love to hear you read Seamus Heaney, because I know that this poem in particular matters to you.
Well, I suppose it's to do really with them. It is to do with these children who come down to the farm, and they work on the farm. They don't come down with a clipboard and just fill in how many eggs there are and how many lambs have been born. They do the stuff, so they go into the vegetable garden and they dig. And there's a wonderful poem, which many people will know, called Digging, by Seamus Heaney. He should be here to read it, really. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, snug as a gun. Under my window, a clean, rasping sound. When the spade sinks into gravelly ground, my father, digging. I look down, till his straining rump among the flower beds bends low, comes up 20 years away, stooping in rhythm through potato drills where he was digging. The coarse boot nestled on the lug. The shaft against the inside knee was levered firmly. He rooted out tall tops, buried the bright edge deep to scatter new potatoes that we picked, loving their cool hardness in our hands. By God, the old man could handle a spade, just like his old man. My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man on Tono's bog. Once I carried him milk in a bottle corked sloppily with paper. He straightened up to drink it, then fell to right away, nicking and slicing neatly, heaving sods over his shoulder, going down and down for the good turf, digging. The cold smell of potato mould, the squelch and slap of soggy peat, the curt cuts of an edge through living roots awakened in my head. But I've no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it.
That lives when you read it.
You smell it, don't you?
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny, you need reminding. I mean, most of us have dug earth from time to time, but the notion that you can describe it, you know, and then you the feel of a potato in your hand when you pick it up.
Mm.
And what's lovely when you read that to children is that many of the children I read to have never picked up a potato out of the ground. And therefore, when they do, this connection with another man's memory, another man's life, and it's these connections between old and young and generations, which is so important for us.
It is, now you say it, the closest you can get to knowing what the world looks like, feels like, smells like, tastes like, through somebody else's perceptions.
Yeah.
And that's rather scary because quite a lot of us have struggled to figure out what it's like to inhabit our own perceptions, but suddenly realizing that there are worlds still there, still accessible.
I'm thinking as you're speaking of, you know, a great painter who could evoke the same sort of feeling of our connection. And if you think of Van Gogh and the notion that you can paint wind in a cornfield, or an angry sky with a storm coming on. And you hear it, and you can feel the wind on your face as you're watching it. I do not know how that's done, but that, I suppose, is the same with poetry. And that's why if I'm going to spend this life learning how to write a story, I'll come back, and I'll be Van Gogh, and I'll be Seamus Heaney the next time.
I think you might not know it, but you probably have. I mean, you clearly have written poems, you have written songs, but you seem to speak about those as if they're rather different from being a poet, that a poet has a different status. And yet, I think something like 2 million people in this country say they have written a poem in the past year, that's more than have played cricket. And I wonder, you don't need to be a poet to write a poem. It can be as natural as breathing.
I think that's really true, and that's what great poetry does teach you. You can have a go. In fact, Ted was, I mean, he wrote this wonderful book, Poetry in the Making, which was all about an encouragement. You can do this stuff. You know, you don't have to be,
yeah, it's not a mountain.
No, it's not a mountain at all. You can do it. Also, you've got something to say.
Which only you can say.
Yes. You see the world the way you see it. You feed it the way you feed it. Tell it down. And that business of writing was really, really important to him. This particular thing, Poetry of the Mating, he contributed to a school's BBC programme called Listening and Writing years and years and years ago when I was a teacher. So I used to use Ted Hughes in the classroom ferociously before I ever met him. But it was because he was probably the only writer out there who was actually saying, this is for you, this stuff is for you. It's not just for me at all. I love doing it, but it's for you as well. And I think he found that as important to him, that business of trying to get people to come and do this. Because that's how he'd grown up. I mean, he was a man who used to wander, a little boy wandering the Yorkshire moors. And he connected what he'd seen and what he'd smelt and what he'd touched and what he'd tasted to words. He wasn't trying to proselytize and say, this is how you do it. He was simply saying, this is how I do it, and I get joy out of it, and this is what I do. And he wanted other children to be able to find their voice. And I remember watching him with children sitting down in front of the fire in Devon, 35 kids who come, I don't know, from Bermondsey or somewhere. And he'd sit there, and he was unbelievably nervous because it really mattered to him that what he was going to say and talk about and read was not a show. And the best poets don't do it to show at all. They do it to communicate. And he wanted these children to hear poems and hear a voice, hear a tune, a song, something in them which would get them reading, get them writing, because he knew that's what had changed his life and could
You said something
all.
Really, which I interrupted, so I'm going to have to ask you to say it again. But it is about communicating the fact that you can do it.
That's exactly it. I grew up as a teacher with sort of Ted Hughes in my head and his generosity, I suppose. And his generosity was not saying, this is a world for just people like me who, you know, really rather bright and have been to Cambridge and know Shakespeare inside out. This is for all of you. And you all have something to say because you all have lives that are different from mine. You come from different places. You have been through all sorts of stuff in your life which I know nothing about, but which the rest of the world, if you don't mind telling them, would like to know about. And in the telling of it, what do? You find your confidence. And it's your confidence and your voice go together. And the more you write, the more confidence you will have, and therefore the better you will write, because you'll be able to speak it freely. I remember he was reprimanding me once. I went to him for solace, I think, because I was in the middle of writing War Horse, and I got stuck. And I didn't have writer's block, I don't think it exists, but it wasn't happening each day as I wanted it to. And I said to him I was in a bit of a pickle. And I expected sympathy. Well, I didn't get it. He said to me something like, well, you shouldn't have got to where you are. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, the thing is, I think before you start writing, before I start writing, I do an awful lot of dream time and thinking it out, speaking it out, not working out ends, not working out rhymes or rhythm, but just immersing myself in whatever it is. In his case, it could be a pike. It could be a fox or whatever, but I immerse myself in the experience I've had with these creatures and what thinking I've had about it. So it's total immersion. You may have only half immersed yourself in this story, and that's what's wrong. So in future, he was saying, don't start until you've done total dream time, until you've been there. You've got to know the landscape, you've got to know the people, and you become part of it. And then when you do it, don't think about the writing as such. Think about the telling of it down. And let it come as if you're speaking to your best friend, as if you're telling a story over a cup of tea, over a drink. Whatever you do, don't stand back and in any way try to impress anyone. Just tell the tale. And I listened to all this and I came away feeling, oh Lord, I've got to start again. And I did. And he was very encouraging that way. He was quite firm. He knew this was a discipline, but he wasn't shouting at you. He was just saying, this is the way you're going to access what you want. And he was right.
So effectively, what you're telling our listeners now is that the work of poetry or of any maker is often the unseen work, the work you do before a single word is committed to paper or to screen.
Most of it. Most of it is that, really. I mean, actually, it's a question children often ask, you know, how long does it take to write a book? Well, it takes you a lifetime, is the truth of it. And because it's been brewing there, and a great poem has been brewing and brewing, it comes out, it's got its moment, and it, just like a plant has, you know, it's going to shoot up and it'll flower. But it's got to do the growing in the first place. And certainly every book I've written has its roots in memory, in meeting people, going places. And it's all there waiting to emerge. And sometimes these things fuse together. And I think poetry is like that. It's just more intense, you know. Do you like Ribena?
Yes.
Well, I did as a child. I loved Ribena and I used to steal it. And the reason I liked stealing it was because I liked drinking it neat. I don't think poets are going to like this, but poetry is like neat Ribena to me. It is and what did people make you do? You had to pour water in it. Well, that's what I've done all my life. I've written stories which are watered down, right, Ribena. Tertius weren't like this either, but he had neat Ribena in his poems.
It's the thing itself.
It's the thing itself, yes.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. I've learnt a huge amount by looking at poetry through your eyes.
Thank you for
saying
so. And
you've done the work.
Have you learnt more about Ribena or poetry in this?
No product placement here.
I should not. And that's the other problem. I should have said blackcurrant juice. I apologise.
That's all right. Thank you very much indeed.
Okay.
For celebrating National Poetry Day with us.
That's a joy. Thank you.
Thank you very much to Michael Morpurgo. Tell Me the Truth About Life is published to coincide with the 25th anniversary of National Poetry Day on October the 3rd, 2019. It's published in association with National Poetry Day and Michael O'Mara.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and share it. Or better still, find a poem that speaks truth to you and let me, Keris Matthews, know what it is on Twitter, using hashtag Tell Me the Truth About Life.